Hello, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. You know what? You're missing a lot, and you can get it very easily. Just point your phone, your computer, I don't know, your car, over to ROFpodcast.com. When you get there, sign up to become a member. It'll cost you just a couple of dimes a day. And when you become a member, you get the full three-hour show without commercials. You get access to over 10 years' worth of archives. And most importantly, you keep this show alive. ROFpodcast.com. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Ian Millhiser from Vox will explain how Donald Trump has done more to hurt the federal judiciary than any other president in recent history. The Nation magazine's John Nichols will stop by to discuss the multiple articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. Heather Digby Parton will be here to run down all the biggest news stories of the week, and our progressive candidate spotlight this week will be with Jessica Scorane, who is primarying Senator Chris Coons from Delaware. You're listening to the radio right now. You should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. And there's also a three-hour member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free with access to over 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down a massive news week. Again, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, it seems like ages ago, and we've had this week the impeachment. Well, we had hearings on Monday in front of the Judiciary Committee where the staff attorneys for the Intelligence Committee functioned as witnesses in basically arguing for and against the case for impeachment as it came out of the Senate Intel Committee. By the next day, we have articles of impeachment basically released. That vote happens this week as well, and the Judicial Committee and Judiciary Committee, and then next week we are anticipating, or this coming week, I should say, a full House vote. This is moving very quickly. But on Monday, we heard from Daniel Goldman and Stephen Castor, the two attorneys. And we also saw the Republicans in their most aggressive attempt to basically change the topic from the actual impeachment to the parliamentary infighting. And to some extent, it seemed to me that that worked. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I think we just have to accept that all these procedures, all these processes going forward on anything, but specifically in terms of impeachment and any kind of oversight hearings, are going to be presented as two parallel investigations, one being run by the Democrats and one being run by the Republicans. In the House, it's the Democrats are in charge, so they kind of, you know, create the kind of process and go first. And in the Senate, it will be the opposite, which we'll see when the impeachment trial happens. That's just how this is going to be. And one is based upon real evidence and facts, which is the Democratic case, and one is going to be based on, you know, just in complete BS and, you know, made up bizarro world counter narrative, which is what they've been doing. And that's what we saw in these hearings. in the House. And, you know, it can be quite effective. I don't know what Democrats can do about it. In fact, I wrote a piece for Salon earlier in the week about studies that have been done on what you do with disinformation and how to deal with it. And it's really difficult because even if you counter it, even if the Democrats were to come, you know, go right back in their face and lay out the facts to counter what they're charging, it still ends up amplifying the disinformation.
And, right, just and mentioning more people, it's basically don't think of an elephant, right? That's basically the what we have.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very difficult problem. I mean, and I think it's much bigger than our current political situation. This is something that's sort of happening to our, you know, epistemology as you know, citizens. We are finding ourselves in this situation more and more, and probably not just in terms of politics, but in terms of a lot of things. You see it with science. You know, it's the obvious place where you see it with global warming, or, you know, anti-vaxxers or that sort of thing. So in any case, not to digress too far into that, but it is an important part of this because we're seeing this play out. There's this sort of dual narratives that are being, and they're using this platform, the Republicans are, to kind of run their own impeachment of the Democrats or Joe Biden or whatever else they decide to throw out there. I agree with you. I think it is pretty effective. On the substance, of course, you know, the Democrats have the facts at hand. I mean, they're by far, and, you know, we have to just kind of hope somehow that the American public, at least a majority of the American public, can see through this, that they have some kind of BS detector that is in working order, because the counter narrative that the Republicans are sending out is if anyone stopped to think about it and had any kind of, you know, a realistic, logical sort of function working, they would see that the idea of Donald Trump being a great corruption crusader is absurd on its face, and that, you know, the his behavior, everything about him is the behavior of a guilty man. Innocent people don't act like this. So, you know, these are really basic sort of instinctive, you know, heuristic ways that most people make decisions, but it's very, very difficult. And this week with I think one of the things about this this hearing I thought was quite interesting. Basically, I mean, they weren't acting as witnesses. What they were acting as is they were presenting the case to the committee. That's how that and it worked that way in the Clinton impeachment as well. The difference is that they also had at the table the president's lawyers there presenting their side of the case. You had a Democrat, a Republican, you know, and the House manager, you had the Republican side, and you had the president's lawyers there too. The president declined to involve himself. So basically, he was left with, you know, the Republican lawyer, this guy, he's just some kind of, you know, Republican hack. He's been there working on this stuff since 2004, I think, on various committees. And what it ended up being, for reasons that really elude me, the Republicans didn't seem to understand that was how it was working, that they were supposed to present their case. And so they had Castor sitting there for the second half, where it was the Intelligence Committee presenting its case, and which was supposed to be what the thing was about. And he performed the role of both lawyers, which was confusing, and the Republicans were upset about it. But it really was their own fault, because they should have put another lawyer there, right? They should have had another lawyer from their own committee, from the House Judiciary Committee, in the first part of the hearing. But apparently they didn't get it, or they only have one lawyer who knows the case, which is probably true. So in any case, that's one reason why it was kind of confusing and weird and strange. But I still thought that Goldman, who is a very skilled prosecutor, I thought he did a good job of presenting that case. I mean, you know, such as, you know, as we know it, for the Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, I thought it was well done. You know, when they got into the parliamentary arguments, I thought, oh, I can't wait to see what idiot in the media basically reacts to this, as opposed to the substance of what we're hearing. And then it turned out the first one I saw was Chris Lizza, who, you know, tweeted something out about an hour into it, like, this is so boring. Like, you know, they're men arguing with each other. Oh. I guess not even acknowledging the women that were involved in both of the arguments. But nevertheless, Yeah, it was interesting in laying out. But the Democrats seem to be moving rather methodically through this. Let's talk a little bit about that when we get back. And also about the other hearing that we saw when we talk about undercutting the right-wing talking points narrative. We got a big dose of that this week. I don't know if it's going to make any difference. We can talk about that as well. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with Digby.
Used to spend my nights out in ballroom. Liquor was the only love I'd known. But you rescued me from reaching for the bottom.
Hey everyone, this is Farron Cousins, the host of Ring of Fire on YouTube.com/TheRingOfFire, and the holiday shopping season is officially upon us, so I encourage everyone out there, if you're looking for the perfect gift for a friend, family member, or even for yourself, go to MikePapantonio.com where you can order all three of Mike's novels, Law and Disorder, Law and Vengeance, and the latest, Law and Addiction, which is tackling the opioid crisis from a perspective of both fiction with a lot of reality tied in. All three books are available right now for purchase. And if you want to get your order in before the holidays, again, go to MikePapantonio.com and place your order. These are great books written by a truly great progressive and legal mind. You do not want to miss out on this. So again, MikePapantonio.com, order all three books in the Law and Disorder series.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about the hearing that took place Monday, seems like years ago, which involved the Democratic lawyer from the Judiciary Committee and the Democratic lawyer from the House Intel Committee. The second lawyer, Daniel Goldman, was functioning as a witness. And then Stephen Castor, who was doing double duty, first half as a staff lawyer for the Judiciary Committee, maybe the Republicans,
yeah,
but then as a staff lawyer for the Senate, for the House Intel. I think, you know, that made sense insofar as, like, they didn't want to make it like a big deal. They just, you know, they wanted to underplay this. They got, you know, they were sufficiently parliamentarily obstructionist, I guess. Maybe that's too harsh of a word, but they were overly parliamentary and made the story about that. But I think the Democrats were also perfectly fine with that, at least the leadership, right? They don't seem to be pushing him. We're going to talk about the U.S. MCA. This is the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement later in the program. But we can at least mention that on the day that they introduced their articles of impeachment, they also announced that they had struck this big deal on this trade deal. I mean, so it's quite clear the Democrats are, well, driving with the brakes on, you know, playing defensively. I don't know. There's about four different metaphors that come to mind, none of them healthy, it seems to me. But give me your take on that, and then let's move on to this question of the Inspector General Horowitz, who also not only released his report, but testified over the past, I don't know, week and a half now, but he testified on Wednesday to the Senate Judiciary Committee. But first, your perspective on the way the Democrats are playing this impeachment at this point.
Well, there's a kind of a perfunctory feeling about it. Like, you know, I guess they think that they want to make sure that everybody knows they didn't really want to do this, that they were forced into it. So, you know, come on, let's just get this over with. I mean, that's the feeling I get, which is that, you know, they and people, you know, Pelosi will be asked about it and she'll say, well, we don't have a time limit, but it's clear that they have a time limit. They want to get it done before Christmas and then the Senate trial, and then they can get back to business. And I keep asking, and no one has an answer for me on this, what happens then? So they get the impeachment out of the way. They get presumably the you know, Senate does not convict. It would be a huge stretch to think that they could get, I don't know what, they need to get 13 votes, something like that. They're Republican votes, they're not going to get that. And that's assuming all the Democrats vote for it, which, considering right. some of the stuff we've heard from Joe Manchin, for instance, indicates they may not even go for it. So you know, the idea is, let's get this thing over with. Let's hurry up. This is just, you know, almost as if it's kind of, you know, a waste of time, a sort of a duty that they kind of have to do, but it really doesn't mean anything. And, you know, despite the fact that they keep saying, but, well, we have to stop the president from, you know, stealing the next election. It's an urgency. We've got to do that. And yet, after he's acquitted, he's going to run around the country saying that he beat the rap. And, you know, look at me. I'm the most, you know, powerful man on earth. And I don't think that'll stop him from doing anything. I mean, clearly, he believes every time he gets off the hook that that's a green light to go do it again. So I don't understand this. And I, you know, again, you and I've talked about this a bunch, you know, whatever strategies to do with the Senate, which I think is probably part of this, whatever it is, the impression they're giving is that they're in a big hurry to get this behind them. And I don't think that is a good way to be presenting this. It, you know, they're trying sort of, you know, half-heartedly to say, well, you know, there's this urgency because of the election. But like I just said, that doesn't make logical sense, since they know he's going to be acquitted. Everyone knows he's going to be acquitted. So, you know, the whole point of this impeachment exercise, which it is, it's an exercise, knowing that he's not going to be acquitted by this, you know, cult-like following he has in the Republican Party, is to lay out the case against Donald Trump for the purpose of telling the American people, getting it on the record, and then we know that the voters are going to have to choose. So I don't know why they think it's a good idea to have narrow impeachment, you know, impeachment articles, or only concentrate on this one thing, because to me, the whole exercise is about exposure, and you would want to have it all. You'd want to have people coming in talking about his charity, for instance, which they just fined him $2 million in New York and made a ruling that he could never have another charity because of the misuse of charitable funds. I mean, that's a terrible thing. That should be out there, right? I mean, that should be something people hear. I mean, there's just, there are...
And can we be clear on what we mean when we say misuse of charitable funds?
Right.
I mean, that they stole the money from the charity, right?
Like,
I mean, when you collect money for a charity and the money goes to yourself, essentially, that it's a misuse of charitable funds. It's basically just stealing.
Right, exactly. And, you know, this forum of the impeachment trial, the impeachment hearings, this is one place. And granted, it's a mess because the Republicans are throwing out all this other garbage. But nonetheless, it is a forum in which they've got nonstop coverage on the cable networks, and the evening news is leading with it, the front pages of the papers. It's big news that has people's attention. This is when you have a chance to get all this stuff out and to make sure that it sort of is part of a full case against Donald Trump. So, you know, I don't know. You know, look, everybody tells me, you know, why you're just bashing Pelosi, or you just, you know, you hate the Democrats, and you should trust the Democrats to do the right thing. And, you know, so I don't know. Maybe they know better than me, but it just doesn't seem obvious as far as I can tell.
I would argue that the agenda that you and I share about why impeachment is different from Nancy Pelosi's, frankly. And once I think we get a sense of that, a lot of things make sense, including the passage of the USMCA. You and I will talk about that in the next hour. We got to take a break here. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be back in a minute. Digby will join me in the next hour. See you then. Coming up, Ian Millhiser will explain the impact Donald Trump has had on our federal judiciary. Spoiler alert, it's not good. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Donald Trump won't be president forever, but his judicial lifetime appointments may shape the laws of this country for multiple generations. Here to explain the impact on our court system, Ian Millhiser from Vox. So, Ian, in many respects, I don't know if we've actually passed a specific milestone, but we're pretty darn close. I mean, and certainly we've passed a milestone if you were comparing apples to apples. But where are we just on a sheer numbers basis? Where are we in terms of Donald Trump's influence? And really, we're talking about Mitch McConnell, but the right. Two of them, their influence on our judiciary system at this point, you know, in sort of like absolute numbers, but also relative to what we have seen in the past with presidencies and what we could potentially see in the future.
Right. So, I mean, Trump has had more impact on the judiciary than any president, you know, at least any recent president in this short a period of time. You know, he's got two Supreme Court seats. One of those seats he only got because McConnell held it open. You know, should have been Obama's seat, and McConnell held it open until Trump could fill it. He's appointed 48 judges to the U.S. Court of Appeals, which is, you know, in many cases, most cases don't get heard by the Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals is the end of the road for, you know, tens of thousands of cases. And if you're, you know, right now, Trump has appointed 48 judges to those courts of appeals. Obama only appointed 55. So Trump's appointed almost as many in 3 years as Obama appointed in 8 years. So there's been this really concerted effort. You know, I mean, no legislation is passed in Congress right now except for, you know, very minor bills or like, you know, this new trade deal that's virtually the same thing as the old trade deal. What is happening is that McConnell has turned the Senate into a factory that kicks out judicial confirmation. And, you know, often it's the Federalist Society is feeding Trump names. He nominates them. They go to McConnell. McConnell confirms them. If there are any kinds of roadblocks, they just steamroll past them. You know, there's a judge who's about to be confirmed. And the ABA, you know, the American Bar Association evaluated this guy and said, hey, dude, like, this guy's kind of lazy. Like, do you really want someone who's this lazy and who like only focuses on really ideological cases to be a federal judge? And the Republican response was to go after the ABA. So their goal is to, you know, no matter what it takes, forward with judges. And I'll close with this. They're doing it for one very particular reason, which is that as Congress becomes more dysfunctional, the judiciary is becoming the locus of power in this country. And so Republicans know if they control the courts, they control the country.
So I want to put this in some other context so that people can understand. When we talk about 48 appointments to the Court of Appeals, we're talking about lifetime appointments. You've written right. that in the main, they're about 10 years younger than the average Obama appointee was at that time that he appointed them. And again, we should say 55 over the course of 8 years, 48 for Trump over the course of 3 years. How many courts, how many of these? And like you say, and people should need to understand this, when you're talking about these court of appeals, this is basically where law gets codified, I guess, or made on some level in terms of the way that, you know, when there's a question about a law, this is where it's interpreted. This is where it goes because very few cases make it to the Supreme Court. How many of these courts, and the, what is there, about 16 circuit courts around the country? 13?
So, there's 13 federal circuit courts.
Okay. How many of those have flipped?
Off the top of my head, I don't know how many have flipped under Trump. But Trump came in with Republicans having a tight grip on many of these courts. So, you know, the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, you know, the Eighth Circuit were very, very Republican courts throughout the Obama administration. And they stayed that way at the end of the Obama administration. Now, since then, I believe that Trump has flipped the 11th Circuit. I believe he's flipped the Second Circuit. You know, he's appointed a whole lot of Republicans to the Ninth Circuit. So what's happening is that, you know, he is flipping these courts. And that matters for several reasons. It matters, first of all, because, you know, like we were saying, most cases will never be heard by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court hears less than 70 cases in most years, and they get to pick which cases they want to hear. So, you know, it's like winning the lottery to get the Supreme Court to take your case, or, you know, maybe losing the lottery to get the Supreme Court to take your case. The courts of appeals hear thousands of cases. And then the other thing is that the courts of appeals are where ideas are generated and they're mainstreamed. So one way to get the Supreme Court to take a case is if two different courts of appeals disagree on the same question of law, the Supreme Court will almost always take that case. So if you've got some radical idea and you can find some nutso panel on a court of appeals to buy into your radical idea, then you've created one of those splits and you can force the Supreme Court to hear the case. And maybe the court won't do exactly what you want them to do, but it's a pretty conservative court. They can use that as a vehicle to move the case to move the law to the right. They can use it as a vehicle to mainstream ideas that historically, you know, have been considered ridiculous. But if, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 courts of appeals all agree with an idea, it's harder for someone like me to say, yeah, but that's just not what the law said.
Since we're just talking about the raw dynamic that's changing here, Democrats, I mean, we've compared it to the past, and you've told us that Trump has had more impact on the courts than certainly any president in our lifetime, going back over 100 years, who knows, maybe 90 years, let's say. It seems to me going forward, the chances that we can catch up are also really small, right? Because the Senate tends to be favorable to Republicans because of the way that it's set up in terms of how many states have less populations. They still get the same representation. In the event that the Democrats ever take the Senate, it's likely that they also have the House, in which case you're going to start to legislate, which is going to take up time in the Senate. And the sort of on some level, the success of changing the judiciary will be a victim of the success of attempts to legislate other laws. I mean, do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, the lopsidedness here is twofold. I mean, one is that because of Senate malapportionment, you know, you have all these small states that still get two senators, and that effectively just gives a bunch of extra Senate seats to Republicans. You know, right now, there are 53 Senate Republicans, and those 53 Senate Republicans represent 15 million fewer people than the 47 Democrats. So, you know, the Senate is malapportioned all to hell. And then there's two implications of that. One is that it's just really, really hard to get a Democratic Senate.
Right.
The second implication of it is that if you do get a Democratic Senate, you know, if you have a 51 Senator Republican Senate, chances are the 51st Republican is still really, really conservative and really on board with, you know, getting Trump's judges through. You know, Susan Collins, who's the most moderate Republican, voted for Brett Kavanaugh. If you have a Democratic Senate, chances are that the marginal vote is going to be held by a pretty conservative Democrat, a Joe Manchin, a Kyrsten Sinema, someone like that. And so that person, you know, I mean, I don't think that Kyrsten Sinema is like you know, for Arizona, she's a pretty good Democrat. And so, like, I don't think that she's going to support a blockade on Democratic nominees. But is she going to support the kind of crusade to march the courts to the left in the way that McConnell's marched them to the right? I don't know. Probably not.
And look, the fact of the matter is, if the Democrats take the Senate, Kristen Sinema may not be on the full right flank, frankly, depending on who gets elected in 2020. All right, we need to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the implications of Trump's court and how we got here. Because going forward, the Democratic senators hopefully have learned some lesson that will mitigate this disaster in the future. We shall see. Going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio with Ian Millhiser. You tell me you're part like it. Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a 5-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Ian Millhiser from Vox about his article, What Trump Has Done to the Courts Explained. So, Ian, in the last segment, you basically put into context for us just how much impact Donald Trump has had and Mitch McConnell have had in terms of right-wing, really right-wing, deeply conservative, lifetime judges on, in particularly the circuit courts. This is the Court of Appeals. This is where a lot of the law is made. These people are younger than in the past. There's more of them after 3 years, almost the same amount that Barack Obama got in 8 years.
Right.
What are the implications? Like, what are we going to see from a material standpoint? What are the changes we're going to start to feel over the next 5, 10, 15 years?
So the big thing I see going on at the Supreme Court level is that the Supreme Court is effectively transferring power from the other branches to the judiciary. So, you know, the Clean Air Act, for example, says that the EPA has a pretty broad power to say, like, hey, there's new technology that makes it easier for power plants to produce energy more cleanly. So guess what, guys? You got to use the new technology. You know, there's lots of laws that delegate that kind of power to federal agencies. The Supreme Court is about to give the judiciary a veto power over a lot of those regulations. And so in practice, the way that that works is the Supreme Court will hand out, like, say, hey, there's a new rule for what sort of regulations are allowed. It'll be kind of vague, like, you know, there'll be some description of what the new rule is, but there'll be a lot of play in the joint. And so the lower courts will then be handed this pretty vague standard. And if the lower courts are stopped by Trumpy judges, they're going to be inclined to strike down the kinds of regulations that Democrats like. You know, think of a case like Hobby Lobby. You know, Hobby Lobby was the first case that said that religion can be used as a sword to cut down the rights of others. Before Hobby Lobby, the rule was that, you know, we had pretty robust religious liberty protections in this country. But the one thing that you couldn't do is you couldn't say, like, my religion is so important that I'm going to take away some other person's rights. Hobby Lobby was the first case saying that a religious person can take away the rights of someone else. And, you know, we're getting a few more cases building on Hobby Lobby. It hasn't been fleshed out that much. What's going to happen is the Supreme Court's going to hand down a few more cases saying, like, well, you know, maybe you don't have to follow anti-discrimination laws. But they're going to be, you know, those decisions, there's going to be some play in the joints. And then it's going to be left to the Trump judges in the lower courts to decide whether or not religious conservatives are allowed to discriminate or not in individual cases. So, like, that's how this works. The way that it works is that the Supreme Court will change the law, typically announces a standard that isn't entirely clear. And that lack of clarity is what gives these lower court judges their power, because then, you know, they have a broad range of discretion to figure out what they want to do, and they're going to do the thing that's good for the Republican Party.
And this is known as a non-delegation. My understanding is I think we had 8 months in this country where the judiciary sort of operated under that idea. It's that radical that it has existed in this country only for literally 8 or 9 months. Is that right?
Yes. Non-delegation is that. That's the idea that there are strict limits on Congress's ability to delegate power to agencies like the EPA. And
so, in other words, just to be clear, it's when Congress says, look, EPA, your job is to make sure that our water is drinkable. We don't have the ability to test every, you know, a pond that's out there and know, you know, what things constitute a danger to people. That's your job. And in this situation, that might be too much authority to delegate to the EPA, according to the courts.
Right. So, like, to give an example of how this plays out. So the Clean Air Act says that certain power plants have to use the best available technology that can be used to reduce emissions, taking into account other factors such as cost. So the idea is that if Congress had passed a law in the 70s saying, hey, power plants have to use this technology to reduce emissions, well, that was in the 70s. Like, there's much better stuff we can do right now. And it potentially could have frozen us in place using really terrible technology. So instead of saying, hey, you've got to use this specific thing, they said to the EPA, what we want you to do is monitor the technology. And as it gets better, and as we, you know, as we can do more to produce cleaner energy, EPA, your job is to say, okay, the technology has improved so much, now it's time for people to use better tech. So Congress sets the broad policy, we should use clean technology, it should be the best available technology. The EPA figures out what that is at this particular moment. If you take that power away from the EPA, then you can no longer have that dynamism. Then you no longer have someone who's constantly watching what the new technology is to figure out what can be done. Then you're potentially back in the world where Congress has to pass a law saying, okay, you must use this particular machine in your factory. And if 20 years from now that machine is outdated and is actually worse, you're making the problem worse, the only way to fix it is to pass a new law act of Congress.
Okay, and that's just—I mean—that is just like one of the big. That's almost like a nuclear bomb going off in the judiciary. All right, so we just have about 3 more minutes left. How did we get here? Like, how is it that Trump was able to appoint so many judges, have such impact, and not just the sheer amount, but the nature of the judges?
Yes. So there's a lot of factors here. One is that after Republicans took over the Senate for Obama's final 2 years, they virtually shut down judicial confirmations at the appellate and the Supreme Court level. You know, everyone knows about Merrick Garland, who they wouldn't even give a hearing to, but they really didn't let Obama get any other appellate judges through either. You know, in his final 2 years in office, Obama confirmed 2 federal appellate judges. Bush, just to give you a comparison, confirmed 10. So, like, you know, they shut that whole process down. Part of the problem is Pat Leahy. Pat Leahy was the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was a Democrat for 6 years of the Obama presidency, but he thought it was really important to protect the rights of the minority. So he gave minority senators the power to veto judges from their state. And so individual Republican senators just held certain seats open forever, you know, or at least until Trump could fill them. And, you know, and then, of course, once Pat Lee was no longer the chair and once there was a Republican president and a Republican chair, all of a sudden no one was protecting those particular minority rights anymore. You know, so Leahy, you know, frankly got played by, like a fool here. And then the third factor is filibuster reform. And I mean, I think like filibuster reform emerged from the fact that Republicans wanted to keep control of the D.C. Circuit, which is probably the second most powerful court in the country. And so they just said, well, we're going to filibuster anyone Obama nominates to three vacant seats on the D.C. Circuit so that Democrats don't gain control of it. And it was that was the thing that caused Democrats to go, we just can't have this. We've got to be able to confirm our judges. So they got rid of the filibuster for lower court judicial nominees. Well, one consequence of that, though, is that when there's a 60 senator threshold, the Federalist Society couldn't put up its most visible ideologues.
Right.
Because they put up their most visible ideologues, the Democrats would say, no, we're going to filibuster that person. In the absence of a filibuster, in a Republican Senate, you only have to get Republicans on board. And so that's the third factor.
That's the one that gets the most virulent. Well, listen, we're out of time. I can't encourage people enough to go and read this. The left has been sleeping on judges for as long as I've been alive, it feels like. And they're about to get a rude awakening. Ian Millhiser, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Ian Millhiser is a senior correspondent at Vox, where he focuses on the Supreme Court, the Constitution, and the decline of liberal democracy in the United States. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.